Paisley Rekdal is the author of a book of essays, The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee, and three books of poetry, A Crash of Rhinos, Six Girls Without Pants, and The Invention of the Kaleidoscope. She received the Village Voice Writers on the Verge Award, an NEA Fellowship, the University of Georgia Press Contemporary Poetry Series Award, a Fulbright Fellowship, Pushcart Prize, and the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Fellowship. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, NPR, The New Republic, Poetry, Tin House, the Kenyon Review. And this year she has two new books, Intimate, a hybrid photo text memoir that combines poems, nonfiction, and fiction with photography, and Animal Eye, a collection of poems from the Pitt Poetry Series. And today we'll be talking about both of those. Welcome to the show, Paisley.
Welcome, Paisley.
Thank you so much.
There's a couple of things I want to ask you before we get literary.
Okay.
Tell me about your name, Paisley.
You know, it's so, first of all, I should say thank you guys for having me on this program. I'm so happy to be here.
It's our pleasure.
I wish I had a better story. I have no good story for this name. You know, my mother, she's Chinese American, but, you know, was raised in the States. So it wasn't a question of not knowing the language. Uh-huh. She knew exactly what she was doing, which makes me wonder if she was a bit of a masochist or sadist, actually, because both of us had to go through so many questions. You know, people ask me all the time, like, in a polite way, which is, you know, were your parents on drugs when this, decision was made? And actually, no. They won't even take aspirin. They're just such clean living people, not like their daughter. So there's almost nothing. Every year I ask her, I said, what were you thinking? And it was my mother's decision. She said that if I ever became famous, I could go by one name. And she just laughed and laughed. And she just thought that was funny. My father, if I'd been born a boy, my father was going to get to choose a name. It would have been Rufus.
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 Oh, my God.
I know. So one could say I really lucked out.
Oh, no. One could say that, yeah.
I think it's a fantastic name. You know, you're in Utah, aren't you?
I am in Utah.
So what is the writer's life like in Utah? I imagine with the natural beauty there, the snowy mountains and the trees, it can really contribute or reinforce your quite obvious love for landscape.
You know, it's funny, since I grew up in cities and lived in very urban areas around the world most of my life, I had not been interested in landscape at all, and it really wasn't until moving to Utah that I became fascinated with it and was really just blown away, like you said, by the beauty of this landscape. And I think it does inspire writers. Obviously, Terry Tempest Williams is here, and she's written very movingly and very powerfully about the connection of especially Mormon settlers and the legacy of Mormons in Salt Lake and around the area with a landscape. It's a really rich writing culture here because where I teach, the University of Utah has a PhD in creative writing program. So we get a ton of students from around the country wanting to come here. And a lot of them stay, or I shouldn't say a lot of them, a number of them stay. We have a lot of, and it's generated a lot of community interest in writing in general. So this place is kind of lousy with poets, to be honest. and I wouldn't say that all of us are as inspired or equally inspired by nature. In fact, this seems to be kind of a home for increasingly conceptual writing, which really is very far away from the pastoral literary tradition in a lot of respects. So it's been exciting to sort of talk to and be among other writers that do very different things. But all of us are, I think, fascinated by the landscape. And it's not just a geographical landscape that's amazing, but it's a political landscape. It's a cultural landscape. I mean, it's all these sorts of layers that people are responding to. This next semester, I'm really excited. I'm going to be teaching a nonfiction class called Mapping Salt Lake City.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm giving each student, assigning them a neighborhood or an area of Salt Lake all the way to West Valley and some of the places where the Tongans and the Samoans have settled. And they're going to write essays, you know, doing research, historical research, thinking about what this place means to so many of the communities that have been here.
But, you know, Paisley, your work does have a lot of landscape in it, but it's also conceptual.
Well, that's nice to hear, actually. No.
It is.
Well, I was thinking, I think that might be true, especially for Intimate, that the newest project, or I should say one of the newest projects that just was published, because it's basically like a braided memoir. I mean, it's got this story of Edward Curtis, it's got the story of his crow guide, Alexander Upshaw, and then, of course, the story of my parents, woven into it. It's got poems, and it was conceptual, I think, ultimately in its formal development, because I had to think about how to put all of these stories together, and I was really taken when I was doing a lot of research, but I was doing a lot of research on everything, including, of course, the history of photography, and one of the classic texts that you read is, of course, Susan Sontag's On Photography, and she said something I thought was brilliant. She said, you know, a literary fragment is a snapshot. Mm. And when I thought about that, it all sort of snapped into place, which is that, you know, what I'm really trying to do is create a photo album. And so to think about chunks of fragments, literary fragments, poetic fragments, memoir fragments, and putting those together as a kind of photo album. And like most photo albums, at first it may look disorganized, but after you start to read it through, there's actually a narrative that is sort of tightly woven, I hope, you know, together between, you know, these different strands, these different individuals. And so I think that is probably the most conceptual thing I've done.
When I was going through your book, Intimate, that's the question I asked myself, is it, how did you go about learning how to organize this book?
Oh, man, it was a nightmare.
I bet it was.
7 years. I started thinking, when I first was looking at Edward Curtis's photographs, and I grew up with them, but I just sort of never knew what they were, because I grew up in Seattle, and he had a studio in Seattle, and there were just these images everywhere, these famous, these iconic portraits of these Native Americans. And I sort of took it for granted, I think, like a lot of people in the Northwest did, of this beauty. So I thought, when I finally started, you know, looking at it and thinking about it, I thought, well, this will just be a short series of poems. And then it became obvious that the poems couldn't get into some of the complexities that Curtis's work raises, which is when he fakes some of these very famous shots, when he erases things and when he poses people and when he works against that documentary impulse and tries to make it an artistic production, suddenly he takes away a certain way of thinking about authenticity that we might feel more comfortable with. And so I thought, well, I can't get that in a poem as easily. You almost have to say that. I thought, well, I'll just write an essay that goes with the poems. And then that was falling flat. I kept thinking, why am I really bothered by this? Why does it bother me so much about this issue of representation? And the more I thought about it, and at the time my mother was undergoing treatments for some pretty serious cancer problems that she was having, and it really became interesting to me to see how bodies get represented in illness, how they're treated in illness, how people sort of move in and out of sort of being themselves and then just being bodies that are cared for. And I can't really articulate what it was about that, but suddenly all of it started to move into place, which is, I mean, representation and identity are things that all of us are obsessed with in one way or another. And I think with race, it just becomes so immediately apparent the ways in which we choose to represent ourselves and the ways in which we visually represent other people, people who are not like ourselves. And I think that, you know, being someone who's mixed race, like I said, my mother's Chinese American, my father's a mixture of whites, mostly Norwegian, you know, it just became something that I was personally quite interested in. And what interested me also is I was doing the research for this project and I would talk to people and, you know, and I did readings down here in southern Utah as well, on a couple of reservations, and people would come up to me afterwards and say, are you, which tribe are you from, you know, and I would be like, no, I'm not, you know, because I've got this appearance that can sort of blend in potentially depending on the context. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by that, this idea of, like, who owns what kinds of stories, how do they get told, and what kind of investment we have in them. So this is a really long answer to your question, but,
I think it is, and I think it's great. I like that you talk about representation, because I've always wondered, and I wonder even more after reading your book, was Edward Curtis involved in a colonialist enterprise?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In some ways, that's the question, right? It's the question that bedevils his 20-volume series. I would say, and I'm going to be very generous here, I would say no, but at the same time, accidentally, yes. I mean, if you look at a lot of the things that Curtis did, I think he was so deeply invested in tribal rights, and he really admired, deeply admired the people that he was photographing. I think that comes out in his work. I think he was desperate to get a kind of attention focused on these people who, and this is where it shades into the yes, which is, in order to make that kind of project, I think, attractive for a white audience, I think he had to sell it as, these are people who are not threatening. These are people who are, in fact, threatened. These are people who are not like you and me, the white people reading these books. They are people who are absolutely different from us. They are primitive. They are the noble savage. They are what they are. But they need to be preserved. However, that project is impossible because they are disappearing. And that's what's so frustrating and fascinating about it, that that's where it really shades into that colonial project, which is, well, actually, in order for this to, you know, this project to kind of go, then there has to be this very almost hierarchical definition of what is white and what is Indian. And to be American Indian is to be the disappearing, the anti-modern, the primitive. And while he had a lot of respect, I think, and love, I mean, he was friends with Geronimo. I mean, he was close with some of the people he photographed. To a certain extent, he was so wrapped up in telling a narrative that it made him blind to certain things. It made him really, his vision very static in ways that, as an artist, I also find a bit heartbreaking. I always tell people this about Edward Curtis, which is, if you look at his dates, his birth dates and his death dates, they are the same as Edward Weston. And if you know Edward Weston's work, I mean, here's right. This you know, amazing modernist photographer, someone who pretty much changes the face of American photography in his lifetime, and working at the same times that Curtis is. And Curtis, because he was so wedded to this idea of these tribes disappearing, and he chose a medium and he chose a way of using that medium that was so itself antiquated, even when he started it was a bit antiquated. By the time he finished his project, like, it was as if he, too, as an artist, kind of disappeared. People weren't reading his books. People weren't looking at his images. You know, his photographic technique, this glass plate technology, was, like, so outmoded. No one, why would anyone do something like that? And when I think about that, I just think, if he was part of this colonialist project, he made himself as much a subject as a master of it. You know, he disappeared himself in the same ways I think he tried to disappear some of his subjects.
I think all of us, in one way or another, are implicated in a colonialist, you know, enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of, do you know the cultural anthropologist Renato Rosaldo?
No.
Who has a concept of imperialist nostalgia.
Yes.
And, which is like, we mourn for that which we kill.
Yeah.
You know, the Native Americans did not disappear.
Exactly.
We killed them, but we didn't kill them all. We changed their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, whatever it is to be Native American or to be an Indian, we've intervened, but they're not gone.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point to raise. And in fact, imperialist nostalgia is the perfect phrase for exactly what Curtis was doing. And what you just brought up is, I mean, I think at the heart of when you go to the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., you go in there, and it's a brilliant museum because you walk in and you expect, you know, the story that you would always get in a museum, which is, let's look at the past. And their whole thing is, you want to see these portraits, you want to see these beaded, you know, costumes, you want to see these rituals, you're going to have to search for it. You're going to have to go into the archives because we're going to show you a bunch of pictures of people who are still living. And we're going to tell you stories about people who are today living in cities and doing things. And I think that's exactly what you need to remember, which Curtis could not see. He didn't want to photograph people who were mixed race, in large part because it was an example of that Native culture blending into white culture. It was an example of people starting to mix and to enter the kind of modern world that had to be white, that had to be utterly different. But that's not what happens. In fact, authenticity is, I think, this buzzword we use that means nothing because it suggests a static identity that none of us ever possesses because we're always changing. We're always adding new things into our diet, our songs, our stories, our language. And the fact that, you know, Curtis didn't want to see that, didn't want to see these people wearing, you know, denim and, you know, driving cars and living in cities or living on reservations. You know, the ways in which we ourselves, as you pointed out, changed this culture, changed all of these different cultures to resemble or to be part of ours, and vice versa.
Yeah, I always avoid restaurants that say authentic Mexican food.
Oh, yeah, because you know it's going to be awful, right?
I choose the restaurants that say comida mexicana. We're talking to Paisley Rekdal, whose new book, Intimate, an American Family Photo Album, is a very interesting hybrid of poetry, memoir, nonfiction. Three major threads in terms of the writing. There's the story of Edward Curtis, the photographer, and then the poet and her family, the little bit of your family in there. And then one of the most interesting figures who I suppose for me has metaphorical meaning when I think of the indigenous Mexicans and how the conquest could not have been achieved in the way that it was without these particular guides. And here you have this interesting character named Alexander Upshaw, and he's a very important part of this book. Can you talk a little bit about him and his role?
Yeah, Upshaw was somebody who I didn't want to bring into this at all.
so you did, but he asserted himself, I guess.
I really, because I didn't want to do what I think is inevitable when writing about this, which is to turn into another kind of Edward Curtis. And I acknowledge that I do that in the book. I Curtis myself by trying to imagine that this what this person's life was like. Upshaw was a real person. He really worked for Edward Curtis. He left a scattered record. And what, to a certain extent, we know about him, we know as much through the photographs that were taken of him and left as we do of any written record that he himself had left or any of the activities he'd engaged in. He had worked for Crow Rights very hard towards the end of his life, and that's the reason he was murdered, actually. But he began life in a very different way, which was that he was raised in Carlisle, the famous school in Pennsylvania that was all about this idea of assimilation, above all things, assimilation. So they would take kids from all of these different tribes and essentially say, you can be American if you do all of these things, which I find fascinating. Of course, the idea of Americanness is they were born here, but they're still not American, right? They don't get that citizenship granted to them. For them, it's an entire cultural process to earn it. And one of the things that, one of the records that Upshaw did leave was one of those classic essays in which he basically parrots the school party line, which is, and I quote a little bit of it in the book, where he says, you know, this is the whole thing about being an American. If we work hard, if we follow Christian ways, if we, you know, educate ourselves, we completely leave behind all of these native customs and enter this world, we'll, you know, this is how we become Americans. And he moves from that slowly, and I think, I have to imagine this because I don't know, he moves from that to somebody who suddenly is very committed to native rights and very committed to living on a reservation and very committed to making sure that the Crow are treated well and thinking very much about his Crow identity and what that means. There's an old phrase, which is kind of, at the time it was very derogatory, it was called going back to the blanket, and one could say that Upshaw went back to the blanket. He took back all those native ways. And
oh, that's an interesting phrase, going back to the blanket.
Yeah, you know, putting the blanket back on. And it's interesting, like one of the photos, one of the last photos of him, Curtis took. And if you'll notice, I mean, I have it in the book, but if you notice, he starts the book wearing what would at the time would have been a classic sort of young white scholar's, you know, suit and coat and tie and all that sort of stuff. But by the end of the book and by the end of his life is a picture that Edward Curtis took of him where he's wearing his own father's headdress. And he's bare-chested. He's wearing some of the jewelry that his family owned. And he's portrayed as exactly the way he began life. He would never have done that. He never would have said, I'm going to dress up like a Crow, even though I am Crow. But by the end of the book and by the end of his life, he has. He has made the decision to represent himself that way. My theory is, I don't know if it's true, but he married a white woman. He had kids. And I think possibly it was that alongside of the work he did with Curtis, seeing what Curtis did, how he didn't treat his native guides terribly well, the ways in which he was faking and framing some of the shots, and the ways that his own family was getting treated, they were no longer in either of these worlds that he could place. That it was, you know, his decision to say, well, if someone is going to give me an identity, I'm going to choose what that identity is. And I'm going to go and put on the one that everyone has already granted me, and the one that I probably feel like might be the more authentic or useful one for me. Again, that word, authentic. I found, you know, when Obama was you probably remember his famous speech where he was talking about race. And he said, and I always remember this, he said, I identify as African American because that's, even though I'm mixed, and that's partly because that's what most people see me as. And I think, to a certain extent, that resonated with me when I was thinking about Upshaw's character, which I think he had to make a similar decision, which is even though he worked in all of these different worlds, even though his family was also from both worlds, what he was seen as ultimately became the thing that trumped everything. And whether he liked it or not, if he couldn't control that image, if he couldn't control that identity himself, he would be subject to it. Mm. And so that's what I think happened. I have no idea. But I think he's a very fascinating figure. And like I said, I didn't want to write about him, but in a way he becomes, in some ways, the heart of the book, because really he's exactly what Curtis is wrestling with. All of the problems that Curtis is trying to ignore, Upshaw has experienced and is experiencing in the book.
And it's really interesting because it really, one of the questions that your book raises is that, is this the matter of identity is not an easy matter, and it never has been. And it's really interesting that it's, for so many people, an invisible thing.
Yeah, true.
And it's such a construction, of course, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a constant construction. And I think the thing about being, in America, considered a minority of any kind, it just literalizes, I think, the metaphor that we all live with, or the fact that we're all constructing identities. We're always, every single one of us, taking on masks, taking off masks, trying something new on, changing all the time. And this is one of the real gifts, I think, about being either biracial or considered somewhat, you know, out of the norm, whatever that would be, is that you get to know what's happening. You get to really see it, and you get to know, call it for what it is. And to a certain extent, it does release a kind of power. It gives you a kind of power, mm-hmm. I think.
And it does. And what you were talking about is exactly what Chicanos did during the 60s movement. You know, they asserted this identity that was Chicano. And the word was not a good word, but for them it was a good word. And what they were asserting is this kind of mestizaje, you know, that they're not pure. Impurity was beautiful.
Impurity is what we should all strive for.
Right, right. But the fact is that impure is what we all are.
Yeah, yeah. No, again, it goes back to that sort of very frustrating word, the authentic or pure, mm. anything like that is always just a terrible catch word. And it means, you know, it's so nostalgic for a time and a kind of identity and a kind of world that just never existed. Yeah.
You've had a pretty good year. 2012 has been a great year for you. You had another book come out called Animal Eye, which is part of the Pitts Poetry series. Can you tell us a little bit about this book?
Yeah, that one, it seemed so easy to write in retrospect because it wasn't so conceptual, it wasn't so difficult formally to frame it. I mean, it was literally just sitting down and writing some poems and over the course of time seeing how they work together. To a certain extent, I see these as companion books, too. Mm. Both of them are obsessed with vision, imagination versus sight, the idea of really seeing or experiencing versus imagining or witnessing, you know, what does it mean to witness something? I think part of it came from the fact that I was teaching courses on visual poetry and then also documentary poetics, which really obsesses me, this idea of, like, a poem as a document and what that would mean. So Animal Eye, I think it kind of reflects those kinds of obsessions, too. There's a long poem.
Eastern Lisbon?
Eastern Lisbon, that's one, yeah. There's two long poems, yeah. Oh. Eastern Lisbon deals with, it's a narrative that braids together two stories, which is that, actually just one story, but it's a sort of fraught relationship I had with a man who's African-American. We were both traveling together in Spain and Portugal, and this was right around the time of the race riots in L.A., after the Rodney King beatings and the trial and everything, and we'd been living together, actually, in Ireland, in the same dormitory, and we were good friends, and we went on that trip, and it was the most explosive and insane sort of trip, because I think for me it was really eye opening. I had never seen what it would be like to be black in any kind of context, and we had run into so many events. You know, people were just it was the south of Spain. People would scream at us in cafes. People, women would stop by and just yell at him for sitting close to me at all. We went across the border. He was pulled off the bus along with an African who had been there too, and they were just questioned for hours, and then they found out that I was with them, and then I was pulled in. It was just, and I said to him, I was like, how do you, I mean, I was like, is this what it's like? And he goes, yeah, you just don't, he's like, after a while, you just have to stop seeing things. And that always stayed with me. And then, of course, the poem also recounts, you know, spending this day finally on my own in this zoo that goes horribly awry. Basically, this cage has got all of these, you know, thousands of different lemurs in it, and the guards just didn't care. There's all these little baby lemurs kind of, like, running everywhere, like, out in the open. And so I thought about this idea of what is the zoo, but a sort of metaphor for kind of prison we're all in of identity and race, and what it would be like to actually be in a place where the zoo, you know, breaks open. And you know, talked about the kind of, you know, imperialist nostalgia that I was not aware that I had. I mean, I always sort of... It's always one of those things that everyone says, oh, yeah, I'm racist, in this sort of, like, self-congratulatory way. But I think it really was this, you know, kind of shock of awakening that why was I thinking this in a zoo, especially with the Rodney King thing going in the background, and how that was really affecting our relationship, too. And you know, even though politically we're on the same side, suddenly I just thought, wow, there's just so many differences of sight and self-consciousness.
We have this segment called Poem of the Week, and would you be willing to read one of your poems from this book for us?
Oh, sure. I should probably choose a short one.
Personally, I really liked Why Some Girls Love Horses and Arctic Scale. Both of those just blew me away.
I'll read Why Some Girls Love Horses. Why Some Girls Love Horses. And then I thought, can I have more of this? Would it be possible for every day to be a greater awakening? More light. More light, your face on the pillow with the sleep creases rudely fragmenting it. Hair so stiff from paint and sheetrock, it feels like the dirty short hank of mane I used to grab on Dandy's neck before he hauled me up and forward. White flanks flecked green with shit and the satin of his dander. The livingness, the warmth of all that blood just under the skin and in the long, thick muscle of the neck. He was smarter than most of the children I went to school with. He knew how to stand with just the crescent of his hoof along a boot toe and press incrementally his whole weight down. The pain, so surprising when it came, its iron intention sheathed in stealth, the decisive, sudden twisting of his leg until the hoof pinned one's foot completely to the ground. We'd have to beat and beat him with a brush to push him off, that hot insistence with its large horse eye trained deliberately on us. To watch. Like us, he knew how to announce through violence how he didn't hunger, didn't want, despite our practiced ministrations, too young not to try to empathize with this cunning, this thing that was and was not human we must respect for itself and not our imagination of it. I loved him because I could not love him any more in the ways I'd taught myself, watching the slim bodies of teenagers guide their geldings in figure eights around the ring as if they were one body, one fluid motion of electric understanding I would never feel working its way through fingers to the bit. This thing had a name, a need, a personality. It possessed an indifference that gave me logic and a measure. I, too, might stop wanting the hand placed on back or shoulder and never feel the desired response. I love the horse for the pain it could imagine and inflict on me, the sudden jerking of head away from halter, the tentative nose inspecting first before it might decide to relent and eat. I loved what was not slave or instinct, that when you turn to me, it is a choice. It is always a choice to imagine pleasure might be blended, one warmth bleeding into another as the future bleeds into the past. More light, your hand against my shoulder. The image of the one who taught me disobedience is the first right of being alive.
That was lovely.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire, Paisley.
We've been talking to Paisley Rekdal, who has two books this year, Intimate an American Family photo album, and Animal Eye from the Pitts Poetry Series. Thank you so much, Paisley.
Thank you so much.